Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When we listen on Audible, we are unconfined, free to travel the worlds inside our minds, where time moves faster, stops, rewinds. So let's walk and dance a mile in other shoes. Whatever's next is ours to choose. There's more to imagine when we listen. Audiobooks, podcasts, originals. Start listening now at Audible.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and at 1300 GMT on Friday the 2nd of June, these are our main stories. Scientists at Oxford University in the UK say they have promising results from research into a blood test that can detect dozens of types of cancer. The US Secretary of State said Russia's invasion of Ukraine has been a strategic failure. Also in this podcast, in Senegal, police surround the house of an opposition leader after a jail sentence pronounced against him sparked deadly protests. And the top striker in football's Premier League, Erling Haaland, is targeting more success in the FA Cup final.
I'm a simple guy. When I do something and I like it, I want to do it more. I would love to win more trophies because of the feeling. And exactly the same with goals, because just the feeling is so nice.
Scientists here in Britain say they're excited by the results of a trial of a blood test that can detect dozens of types of cancer. The test was able to correctly identify 2 out of 3 cancers, as well as pinpoint their origin. The lead researcher, Professor Mark Middleton from Oxford University, told James Copnell about his findings.
We did a blood test on just over 6,000 people who'd been referred by their GP for urgent tests to rule out cancer, and studied the results of that blood test compared with the tests that they were going to have anyway. The reason we're excited is it correctly identified 2/3 of the cancer, but also we could use the results of the blood test to work out how that affected the probability of somebody who was already having invasive tests turning out to have cancer. And that's the way we see this blood test being used in the coming years. We've still got a little bit more work to do to refine the test so that we can use it as what we would call a rule-out test. So have the blood test. If it's negative, no more tests are needed. The other thing that we can do is there are a lot of patients who come and see their GP whose symptoms are quite vague and are pretty unlikely to be cancer, but about 1/5 of cancers in the UK fall into that group. So if we can give that test to people who don't currently get invasive tests, we should be able to pick out the small minority who need more workup. And then the third use is that the blood test can tell us where the cancer is by looking at the makeup of the DNA in the blood. And that means that some cancers that at the moment we find particularly hard to pin down, we might be able to do the right test first time and speed up diagnosis for them.
It strikes me that 2 out of 3 cancers is extremely good, but perhaps probably not quite good enough for what ultimately you want to do. So is there a prospect that the sophistication or accuracy of the test could be improved?
We think so. Picking up 2 out of 3 for people who are already being sent for urgent investigation isn't good enough. It might be good enough for a screening program in people who don't have symptoms and who otherwise will just carry on with their lives as normal. As far as patients with symptoms are concerned, that's why we say we need to do a bit more work refining what's called the classifier, the clever computerized bit that analyzes the results of the DNA that are in the blood.
Once all this does come together, as we hope it does, is it the sort of test that would be costly, difficult to do, for example, in health systems in poorer countries? Or is it the kind of thing that could be rolled out relatively cheaply around the world?
Relative is the important word here. Yes, it could be rolled out relatively cheaply. The other way in which we see tests like this having potential is that, you know, there are parts of the world where the infrastructure that we have here in the UK with pathologists and the ability to take biopsies and so forth is more limited. And therefore, we see tests such as this as being able to offer diagnosis, perhaps in rural communities without significant health infrastructure, by taking a blood test, bringing it back somewhere central and doing all the work there. And we are trialing it for a small number of cancers in collaboration with partners in Tanzania and Uganda at the moment.
Professor Mark Middleton. The Nordic region has become strategically more important since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Finland has become the newest member of NATO, the Western Military Alliance, with Sweden looking to join too. So it was fitting that following a tour of the region, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken chose to use a speech in Helsinki to set out the latest US position on the conflict. He made the case for sustained Western aid to Ukraine and spoke of what he said were Vladimir Putin's many strategic failures.
President Putin's core aim, indeed his obsession, has been to erase the very idea of Ukraine, its identity, its people, its culture, its agency, its territory. But here too, Putin's actions have precipitated the opposite effect. No one has done more to strengthen Ukraine's national identity than the man who sought to wipe it out. No one has done more to deepen Ukrainians' unity and solidarity. No one has done more to intensify Ukrainians' determination to write their own future on their own terms. Ukraine will never be Russia. Ukraine stands sovereign, independent, firmly in control of its own destiny. In this, Putin's primary goal, he has failed most spectacularly.
Antony Blinken also said the United States was willing to work with other nations to help build a just and lasting peace to end the war with Russia. Our Europe editor Danny Eberhardt told me what else stood out in his speech.
Well, NATO was one of the themes, Nigel. Basically, Finland being NATO's newest member, he's saying that it has strengthened NATO. They've sent more forces to the eastern flank. And that he stressed that basically NATO's door remained open and that any decision perhaps in the future about whether Ukraine actually becomes a member of NATO will be with NATO and NATO allies, not with Russia. On the Russian military, he was particularly strong. He said that President Putin had been trying to build up Russia's military strength for two decades, and it ended up as a case study in failure in Ukraine, he called it. And he said that Russia's military, far from being the second strongest in the world, people are saying now only the second strongest in Ukraine. The economy, the Russian economy was a shadow of itself, he said. There's been a brain drain with a million people leaving Russia. Foreign reserves are down and a flight of foreign capital. And that China, the relationship between Russia and China, was looking increasingly one-sided, and that Beijing were also looking at this conflict and saying basically the West has stayed united and drawing lessons from that.
And it did seem that in the main he was saying that apart from one or two exceptions, the world is coming together to try and deal with this.
Yes, he talked a bit about peace. He said that basically the US would support peace efforts, including ones from China or Brazil or other parts of the world, but only if it was based on the principles of the UN Charter. So fully recognising Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty, for example, and also making sure that there are elements of accountability for Russia in terms of its own crimes in Ukraine, and that it would pay its own fair share of rebuilding Ukraine after a conflict.
Danny Eberhardt. Meanwhile, Russia continues trying to spread its influence in occupied Ukraine. We've heard a good deal about the role played by Russia's notorious Wagner mercenaries in the fighting for the ravaged eastern town of Bakhmut. But a close associate of the Wagner boss, Yevgeny Prigozhin, has been involved in another battle for the hearts and minds of people in territories behind the front lines. Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
A network of pro-Russian TV and radio stations have emerged in parts of Russian-occupied Ukraine since the start of the full-scale invasion last year. They were set up by Alexander Malkevich, who's been involved in projects spreading Russian influence from Africa to the US. He has been doing this through his close ties to Yevgeny Prigozhin, head of the Wagner mercenary group. Just like Prigozhin, Malkevich is sanctioned by the West for spreading disinformation. But this is how he sees his job.
We are all worried about the difficult situation on the information front of the war that has been unleashed against our country. We think that our actions need to be more energetic and harsher in a number of areas. An information war, a hybrid war, has been unleashed against us by the collective West.
Formally, Malkevich's job is running state-funded TV in Prigozhin's home city, St. Petersburg. But in the summer of 2022, he moved to occupied parts of Ukraine, making the southern city of Kherson his base. His main task was to set up pro-Russian television stations in regions captured since the start of the full-scale invasion. He has masterminded ZA TV in Melitopol, Mariupol 24 in the eastern Donetsk region, and Tavria TV in Kherson. Their reporting strictly follows the Kremlin's narratives. Here's an example of what Tavria TV has been showing.
The special military operation has been going on for more than a year. Why was Russia forced to start this special military operation in Ukraine? Russian President Vladimir Putin says the special military operation was a forced step because Moscow had been left with no other choice. Such security risks had been created for Russia that no other reaction was possible.
One major challenge facing Malkevich was an acute shortage of people willing and able to work for his channels. To train staff, he opened a media school in Kherson, became head of the journalism department at the local university, and authored a textbook for aspiring media workers in Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine. Some of his students joined his TV stations before becoming of legal age, and one was only 15 years old.
Thanks to the local administration and Russia's help, we have overcome the crisis and established peaceful life.
But Malkevich's time in Kherson was short-lived. Shortly before the city was retaken by Ukrainian forces in November, he fled together with some of the equipment and staff. While evacuating, they came under fire and one staff member was killed. His work in Ukraine did not go unnoticed by the Russian government, and in January this year, he received an award from Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin for, as he put it, organizing TV broadcasting in territories which are being liberated.
Vitaly Shevchenko. The US climate envoy John Kerry is experiencing for himself the unusually hot temperatures in the Middle East, which is apt as he's there to discuss ways of tackling the climate crisis. Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Yolan Nell. I asked her about Israel's plans to send water to Jordan.
This is a plan. John Kerry was actually present at the signing ceremony over a year ago when Israel and Jordan and the United Arab Emirates signed up to this. It's seen as being very important symbolically and diplomatically because Jordan, of course, is a country that has a real problem with water scarcity. And Israel has managed, using water from the Mediterranean coast, to become really a world leader in desalination technology. So Israel is committed to providing desalinated water to Jordan, and Jordan in return sells to Israel electricity from a new solar energy plant that's being built by an Emirati company, and there are benefits for Palestinians as well. And really it's seen as being the sort of innovative solution that could help tackle climate change, particularly in this part of the world where already, according to a recent study, temperatures in the Middle East and also the Eastern Mediterranean are rising almost twice as fast as the average in the rest of the world.
And we see problems with extreme heat and heat waves in Europe. How equipped is the Middle East to deal with extreme heat?
I mean, it really varies a lot from country to country. Of course, Israel is a country that is known for its high-tech and scientific innovation. Air conditioning comes as standard in homes and offices here. In other parts of the Middle East, just looking as close as the Gaza Strip, which has severe power shortages, it's much more difficult for people to cope. Now, at the moment, I mean, we are getting this sort of spike in temperatures. It's unseasonably hot. In Tel Aviv, it's going to be a sort of sweltering 39 degrees Celsius. We are expecting dust clouds to come for the second time this week. Cairo has been experiencing unusually hot temperatures in the mid-40s and has had severe sandstorms. I'm just hearing from my colleague there that one person's reported to have been killed and several injured as a result of the weather there. And it just underlines really the severity of climate change, what it could mean for this region. Certainly in future, people are expecting longer heat waves, more severe drought, more frequent sandstorms. And it's a way of looking forward to the COP28, which is happening in the United Arab Emirates in November.
Yolande now. Still to come, another top executive in charge of trust and safety resigns from Twitter.
Hi, I'm Izzy Greenfield from Business Daily. We bring you important and interesting stories from the world of money and work. And we've been taking a deep dive into the music industry. It's worth $26 billion a year globally. And I've spoken to industry experts from around the world, from international pop stars and gospel groups to aspiring local artists, to find out what it takes to make it in such a lucrative but exclusive industry. That's Business Daily from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.
Welcome back. There's a standoff in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Police have surrounded the house of the main opposition leader, Ousmane Sonko, who was sentenced to 2 years in prison on Thursday. He was convicted of corrupting youth, but cleared of a rape charge. News of that conviction sparked deadly protests. The authorities said 9 people died in those protests and announced a temporary suspension of certain social media apps. Yassine Fall, the deputy to Ousmane Sonko, said she was outraged by his conviction and claimed it was a confected charge.
Ousmane Sonko was being accused of repeated rape and threat to kill someone with 2 weapons, raping someone while having 2 guns. These were the accusations. So the judge today said that Mr. Sonko did not rape and Mr. Sonko did not threaten to kill. So for that, we are happy because it is a very heavy burden to put on someone. But he has been sentenced for corruption of youth of a woman who is 21 years old. So the corruption of youth was not among the accusation put in front of the court. Now, how can you say that this person is not guilty of the fact, the accusation that were brought to the court that were rape, and then you come back and say, no, he is not guilty of these facts. I'm going to find a new accusation that is corruption of youth.
Our Africa regional editor Richard Hamilton is following events in Senegal. He began by telling us more about Ousmane Sonko.
He's still very young. He's only 48. He was a tax inspector originally, the chief of inspector of taxes, and he uncovered corrupt practices amongst the country's elite, such as offshore tax havens. He even uncovered a tax evasion scheme by a Canadian company that avoided paying around $8 million of tax. He wrote 3 books. He was dismissed for being a whistleblower about taxation. And he was the youngest candidate to stand in the last elections in 2019 when he came third. He's seen by many in Senegal as a rising star. He's particularly appealed to the young student unions, the unemployed, and he's seen as the current president, Macky Sall's, biggest rivals. There were previous protests when these various rape allegations emerged a couple of years ago. There was a big protest movement then, and 13 people died in clashes. And the protests were known as Trop c'est trop, which means enough is enough. And as you say, he's sentenced to 2 years in jail for immoral behaviour. This was to do with corrupting a youth. He was accused by a massage therapist of immoral behaviour. And this would mean, this 2-year sentence means he can't contest the next election next year.
And Senegal in the past has been considered a relatively stable country. So how concerned are people about the direction it may be heading in now?
They are very concerned. And recently, for example, Amnesty International accused the authorities of arresting opposition leaders, banning protests, arresting activists and journalists. There have been allegations of excessive use of force in breaking up demonstrations, of torture of people. Basically, as you say, Senegal was always renowned as a sort of beacon of stability and democracy in West Africa, where that's not always the case. But it seems like the governing party, the coalition, has sort of absorbed some of the opposition figures, hollowed them out, and become a sort of... It's sort of the democratic model has changed into one where there's a dominant party system, which we see elsewhere in West Africa. There's been accusations of political interference in the judiciary, the arbitrary arrests of opposition figures, and even a judge who criticised a court ruling a couple of years ago was severely warned about his behaviour.
Richard Hamilton. This was the moment politicians in the US averted the threat of the country running out of money.
On this vote, the yeas are 63, the nays are 36. The 60-vote threshold having been achieved, the bill is passed.
In a nighttime session, senators approved a bill to suspend the government debt limit after days of wrangling between the Democrats and Republicans. President Joe Biden will now sign this into law, sparing the U.S. from a catastrophic default on its $31.4 trillion debt. The Senate Majority Leader, Democrat Chuck Schumer, told reporters he was relieved.
We've saved the country from the scourge of default, even though there were some on the other side who wanted default, wanted to lead us to default. We may be a little tired, but we did it. So we're very, very happy. Default was the giant sword hanging over America's head. But because of the good work of President Biden, as well as Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate, we are not defaulting.
There's been a positive reaction on the financial markets. Asian and European stocks rose after the announcement. The BBC's Jessica Parker in Washington is following the story.
So this piece of legislation went through the House, the lower chamber, now the Senate, the upper chamber, and it will proceed to Joe Biden's desk. Probably the most predictable part of this process. We know exactly what's going to happen. He will sign it into law. And this follows, of course, extensive wrangling and negotiations between senior Republicans and the White House over this debt ceiling deal. Interestingly, Joe Biden is going to address the nation on Friday night, and he's been keen to try and demonstrate that this agreement contains some wins for him. He's talked about protecting core government programs that are a priority for him, investment in clean energy. But of course, for Joe Biden, he was very keen, will be very relieved that the US isn't going to default on Monday, as the US Treasury warned it might, because it would have happened on his watch, even if he had tried to blame Republicans. So that will be a relief for the White House, and it's a two-year deal, so it means it lives on beyond the next presidential race. He wouldn't want to have had a similar fight like this as he bids for re-election. For the Republicans, the House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, has talked a lot about how he's won spending curbs, welfare reforms, and how the White House didn't even want to do any kind of negotiation over the debt ceiling. They just wanted a clean debt ceiling deal. So he's been trying to chalk up victories there. But the truth is that there are people from both the Democrats and the Republicans who've been critical of the agreement that was reached. And this whole episode has once again exposed not just those ideological and political divisions between the Republicans and the Democrats, but within those parties as well.
Jessica Parker. Twitter's head of trust and safety is reported to have resigned, the second holder of the post to leave since Elon Musk took control. Ella Irwin was responsible for content moderation. Twitter has cut costs savagely under Mr. Musk. Zoe Kleiman reports.
Ella Irwin hasn't given a reason for her decision to stand down. But yesterday, Elon Musk tweeted that many people at Twitter had made a mistake regarding a content moderation protocol to hide a controversial video documentary from people's feeds. And a week ago, the social network pulled out of the European Union's voluntary code to fight disinformation. Elon Musk has denied the conclusions of various studies which indicate that hate speech on Twitter has increased since he took over. He describes himself as a free speech absolutist and says he wants people to be able to express all views on Twitter.
Zoe Kleiman. Now, the Manchester City striker Erling Haaland has exhausted both the superlatives and opposition defenders after his record-breaking first season in the Premier League. As City prepare for the FA Cup final on Saturday against rivals Manchester United and the Champions League final next weekend, the Norwegian has been talking with the BBC's Dan Rowan about the prospect of an historic treble of trophies.
Never, ever misses!
This man is a sensation.
Another Haaland hat-trick!
He's the Norwegian super scorer who's taken the Premier League by storm. In a remarkable debut season in England, Manchester City's Erling Haaland has established himself as world football's most feared striker. And here at the club's training ground, he told me how he was handling sporting superstardom aged just 22.
It's nice. That means I've done something right. My life has changed, of course. I can't live normal, so normal anymore. That's something I just have to admit, and that's how my life is. I can't complain. I like to do a bit crazy kind of stuff, both on and off the pitch.
Like the silk pyjamas, which seem to be becoming something of a trademark of yours.
No, I like to be comfortable wherever I go, and I think it looks really good, so that's why I use it, basically. I'm 196 tall and got long blonde hair, so wherever I go, people are going to see me. So that's how my life is, but what can I do? There's nothing I can do. That's my life. I just had to try enjoy it as much as I can. When I was young, I wanted to become a professional footballer and the best in the world. And a price comes with that. If you're going to be that, there's certain things you have to do different. You have to live different. You have to do this and that. And that's just how it is. I'm not complaining.
Your dream, you say, was to be the best in the world. Have you achieved that dream? Do you believe you are the best goal scorer in the world right now?
Good question. I don't want to answer that. I think someone else should answer that. But I scored most goals this season, I think, so that's a good start.
In an astonishing campaign, the prolific Haaland has scored 52 goals for his club, including 36 in the Premier League, a new record.
And Haaland does what Haaland does.
Is there something which you can identify as the secret to being such a great goal scorer?
For me, it's about keeping the confidence, and I try to never overthink. That's the most difficult thing in this world in 2023. When I score a goal, it's like, oh, this feeling is so nice. I would love to do it again kind of a feeling. So it's easy, really. I'm a simple guy. When I do something and I like it, I want to do it more.
Do you think you can improve?
Yeah. From my right foot to my left foot, from the heading, everything.
Having helped City retain the Premier League title, Haaland's now preparing for the FA Cup final against arch-rivals Manchester United, and then the Champions League final. At stake, a first treble since United managed it 24 years ago.
Because of the history, they will be motivated. It's at Wembley, it's a final. There's so many things, so it will not be an easy game. So that's what I'm saying. We have to play our game. We have to not to think too much.
Champions League, I must ask you, is there something about that competition here in Manchester because it's the one that they've so far struggled to achieve? And what would it mean, do you think, to land it?
No, it will mean everything. This is why they bought me, of course, to the club, to get this. We don't have to hide that. I will do everything I can, I possibly can, to try to make it happen. It's my biggest dream, and hopefully dreams do come true.
The brilliant Erling Haaland. The Berlin-based House of World Cultures is regarded as one of the most prominent cultural institutions in Europe. The building was a gift to the Germans by the Americans in the 1950s and became an exhibition and music space in 1989. Today, Friday, it is reopening after a six-month hiatus under new leadership. He's Professor Bonaventure Ndikung, a Cameroonian. He's the Institute's first black African chief curator. So, does he feel under pressure?
I don't wake up in the morning thinking I'm the first black or whatever. Mm. I wake up thinking of that which I'm tasked with, which is to think of to present and to represent cultures of the world. I think that is most important. I do recognize the fact that it's a historical moment, that as an African, it's not evident that you become the head of such an institution. But we've worked for that, and I think it's long overdue. So the shift, we should shift from just thinking of the fact that it's an African, but what the African is going to do. What am I actually going to do in presenting Asian, European, Latin American, African cultures in this place? I feel that. I feel the pressure. But we are very convinced. I put together a very powerful team with curators from Senegal, Colombia, Cameroon, the Philippines, from the US, from Germany as well, from Kenya. So I am convinced that my team can deliver.
Bonaventure and Deacon. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes Porter, and the producer was Marion Strawn. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.
In 2011, Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant was struck by a tsunami. The future of Japan was balanced on a knife edge.
We are in a nuclear emergency!
But how did the disaster happen, and could it have been prevented?
We are extremely concerned that an earthquake could give rise to a tsunami of up to 40 meters.
Fukushima, an original 7-part audio drama series from the BBC World Service, telling the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath.
This old, proud town has been erased from the world.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.